Welcome to the Healing Plate Podcast. Whole food, real nutrients every day. Healing for your body, the way it was designed to be.
Welcome to the very first deep dive of the Healing Plate Podcast. So, think about the organ inside your head right now. Your brain is, well, it's an absolute energy hog. And the primary fuel it is quite literally built to run on is carbohydrates.
Yeah, strictly carbohydrates.
Right. But for the last two decades, I mean, if you tell someone you're trying to be healthy, the very first piece of advice they give you is usually to cut out the carbs. We've spent years treating the exact fuel our bodies require to function like, I don't know, like it's a dietary villain.
It really is one of the most persistent nutritional paradoxes of our time. You know, we have totally vilified the specific molecule that human physiology fundamentally relies upon.
Exactly, which is why our mission for this deep dive today is to completely untangle the truth about carbohydrates. We are putting the diet culture noise on mute.
Love that.
Yeah. And instead, we have a stack of heavy-hitting, scientifically grounded sources right in front of us. We are pulling from Mayo Clinic Research, physiology texts affiliated with NIH, Medline Plus, and the newly released Dietary Guidelines for Americans for 2025 to 2030. We want to look at the actual undeniable physiology of what happens inside your body when you eat a carbohydrate.
And, you know, to do that effectively, we should probably establish a physiological baseline first.
Okay, lay it on us.
So in clinical nutrition and human biology, there are six essential classes of nutrients that your body is built to receive every single day just to maintain its complex systems.
Right.
Those are proteins, fats, vitamins, minerals, water, and carbohydrates. So vitamins and minerals act as regulators for various processes, and water is obviously the fundamental medium of life.
Right, right.
Now, carbohydrates, along with protein and fat, supply energy. But the distinguishing factor for the carbohydrate is that supplying energy is its primary overarching job.
Okay, let's unpack that concept of energy. Because if carbs are just an energy source, why do we culturally treat like a baked potato so differently than a piece of steak?
Right, yeah.
I mean, both have calories, both provide energy to the body. But literally nobody sits down to a steak dinner and feels guilty about the macronutrients. So what is it about the carbohydrate that makes it behave so uniquely in our biological systems?
Well, the answer lies in the molecular architecture. Because carbohydrates are designed as an energy source, their physical structure directly dictates how your digestive system processes them. We can basically categorize them into three practical structural groups, which are sugars, starches, and fiber.
Okay, and I know people tend to think of sugars as bad and starches as okay, but from a chemistry standpoint, it's really just about the size of the molecule, isn't it?
Size and the specific bonds holding them together. Let's look at sugars first. These are simple carbohydrates. Structurally, they're incredibly small, like composed of just one or two sugar units.
Yep.
So the single units are monosaccharides. That includes glucose, fructose, and galactose.
Right.
Then you have the disaccharides, which are just two units linked together. Huh? So sucrose, which is your standard table sugar, is one glucose and one fructose. Lactose, the sugar found in milk, is glucose and galactose.
Got it.
And because these molecules are just so compact, they require very little breakdown.
And the starches and fibers are on the complete opposite end of that spectrum.
Vastly different, yeah. Those are your complex carbohydrates.
Yeah.
So a starch molecule is essentially a massive chain made of hundreds, sometimes thousands, of individual glucose units just bonded together.
Wow, thousands.
Yeah, and you find these dense chains in things like grains, potatoes, and beans. Fiber is also a complex carbohydrate found in plants, but it has a really unique structural twist.
Which is?
The bonds connecting the sugar units and fiber are built in such a way that human digestive enzymes physically cannot break them apart.
Wait, okay, I want to bridge the gap between the simple sugars and the complex chains for a second. If simple sugars are things like fructose and sucrose, then the natural sugar inside a whole apple and, say, the added sugar inside a can of orange soda, they both eventually break down into the exact same simple monosaccharides in the body.
They do, yes.
So if a molecule of glucose is just a molecule of glucose, does the body even realize whether I ate the apple or drank the soda?
Well, chemically, the end product is identical, but the physiological experience is entirely different. The fundamental metric that changes how your body reacts is speed.
Oh, because of how fast it enters the bloodstream.
Exactly. The whole apple comes bundled in a complex matrix. So those simple sugars are trapped inside cellular walls made of fiber. They're bundled with water and vitamins.
Right.
Your digestive system has to do a massive amount of physical and chemical work to dismantle that apple. And that acts as a built-in braking system. It drastically slows down the rate at which those simple sugars are absorbed into your blood.
And the soda doesn't have that.
Right. The orange soda lacks that fiber matrix entirely. It is practically pre-digested. So when you drink it, there is absolutely no braking system. And those simple sugars just flood your bloodstream all at once.
So if speed is the defining factor between, you know, healthy energy and a system overload, we should probably trace how the body actually physically breaks these foods down. I mean, I know chewing is the obvious first step, but the chemistry has to start early too, right?
Oh, it starts the exact moment food enters your mouth. As your teeth physically crush the food, your salivary glands release an enzyme called salivary amylase. You can think of amylase as like microscopic molecular scissors.
Okay, scissors. I like that.
Yeah. And while you are still chewing, those scissors are already snipping those long, complex starch chains into shorter, more manageable pieces.
Which is why, like, if you hold a starchy cracker in your mouth for long enough, it actually starts to taste sweet, right?
Yes.
The enzymes are creating simple sugars right on your tongue, but that process hits a wall as soon as you swallow.
It does. Because the stomach acts as a major disruption to that chemical breakdown. The environment in the stomach is just highly acidic. It's designed to break down proteins and neutralize pathogens.
Right.
So that sheer drop in pH physically denatures the salivary amylase. It literally warps its shape so the scissors can no longer cut. For carbohydrates, the stomach is largely just a holding and mixing tank.
Okay, so the breakdown pauses in the stomach, and the real heavy lifting has to happen once the food moves into the small intestine.
Exactly. The small intestine is where the environment shifts back to neutral, allowing all that chemistry to resume. Your pancreas pumps out a new batch of scissors, which is called pancreatic amylase, to continue slicing the carbohydrate chains.
Right.
But the final and really most crucial step happens right at the lining of the intestine itself, specifically in the middle section known as the jejunum.
The jejunum. Okay, that is where the brush border enzymes live, right?
Yeah.
Because the intestinal wall isn't just a smooth pipe. It has all these tiny finger-like projections to increase surface area, and they are coated in specialized enzymes. Yes, those microvilli create a massive surface area, and you're absolutely correct about the enzymes. The brush border enzymes are basically highly specialized keys designed to unlock specific disaccharides.
Okay.
So you have maltase, which splits maltose into two singular glucose molecules, sucrose, which cleaves sucrose into glucose and fructose, and lactase, which splits lactose into glucose and galactose.
Oh, which perfectly explains the mechanism of lactose intolerance.
Precisely.
Yeah, because if your body stops manufacturing that specific lactase key, the lactose sugar just passes through the jejunum completely unbroken. It can't be absorbed, so it travels down to the large intestine, pulls in a bunch of water, and ferments.
Yeah, that osmotic pull and subsequent bacterial fermentation is the exact cause of all the bloating and discomfort associated with lactose intolerance.
Wow.
But assuming all the enzymes are present, the end result in a healthy jejunum is just millions of single absorbable monosaccharides, predominantly glucose, and they are ready to cross the cellular barrier.
And getting across that barrier is just fascinating. I was reading the physiology texts on how glucose actually gets absorbed into the body, and it relies on a specific doorway called the SGLT1 transporter.
Yes, the sodium glucose link transporter. The mechanics of this specific doorway are honestly brilliant.
Because it requires salt. Glucose and sodium have to link up. They ride into the intestinal cells together, and as they cross that cellular membrane, they create an osmotic gradient that pulls water into the bloodstream right along with them.
Exactly.
And I realized while reading this that this is the literal science behind oral rehydration solutions. Like, if you have a severely dehydrated athlete or a sick kid, you give them water mixed with a very specific ratio of salt and sugar. The sugar isn't a sweetener at all. It's the biological key to activate that SGLT1 transporter and force the body to absorb the water and salt.
It's incredible. The human body leverages the energy of the carbohydrate to actually drive systemic hydration.
Yeah.
Now, once that glucose crosses the intestinal barrier, it enters the portal vein and is shipped directly to the liver.
And I've always sort of conceptualized the liver as a massive financial clearinghouse.
That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, it sits there looking at all this incoming glucose currency, converting the fructose and galactose into more glucose, and then it has to make a triage decision. Like, do I spend this energy into the bloodstream right now because the body's moving, or do I put it into short-term savings?
And the triage process is just critical because excess glucose in the blood is toxic, but a lack of glucose means the brain shuts down. So we mentioned earlier that plants store their savings as starch.
Right.
Human biology requires rapid on-demand energy to move, think, and react. So we store our glucose differently as a molecule called glycogen.
How does glycogen structurally differ from the starch we eat? Like, what does it look like?
It is intensely branched. So if a starch molecule looks like a relatively straight chain, a glycogen molecule looks like a really dense bush with thousands of tiny twigs branching outward.
Oh, wow.
The biological design here is all about rapid access. Because there are thousands of endpoints on those branches, your enzymes can simultaneously snap off thousands of glucose molecules the exact second you need energy to, you know, sprint or lift something heavy.
And we keep these branched glycogen reserves in two separate bank accounts, essentially, the liver and the muscles. But they have very different rules for how they share that energy, right?
Very different. The liver acts as the generous central bank. Its primary role is to maintain blood sugar levels between meals.
Okay.
So as your blood sugar dips, the liver breaks down its glycogen and just freely releases the glucose back into the bloodstream to keep the brain fueled. Your muscle tissue, conversely, is a closed loop.
It hoards the energy.
Completely. Muscle cells physically lack the specific enzyme required to release glucose back into the blood. The physiological design basically demands that energy stored in muscle tissue stays in muscle tissue to fuel movement.
I see.
So the glycogen in your leg muscles can only be used to move your legs. It literally cannot be exported to help a starving brain.
Okay, this brings up a point of genuine confusion for a lot of people, and I really want to look closely at the dietary guidelines on this, because the liver and muscles have a limited storage capacity for glycogen.
Right.
And when those tanks are full and you eat a surplus of calories, the body converts the extra energy to fat. Now, when people look up the recommended dietary allowance, the RDA, for carbohydrates, it lists 130 grams a day.
It does, yeah.
And it is incredibly common for people to read that and assume 130 grams is a maximum limit. They think, if I eat 135 grams of carbs, my glycogen tanks overflow and I'm instantly storing fat.
Yeah, and that is a fundamental misinterpretation of the data that has honestly caused a lot of unnecessary dietary anxiety. The 130-gram figure is absolutely not a ceiling, and it is certainly not a weight loss target.
Right.
That number actually represents the absolute minimum daily requirement of glucose your brain alone needs to function optimally without triggering metabolic backup systems.
So 130 grams is literally just to keep the lights on in the neurological center?
Exactly. For a functioning adult on a standard 2,000-calorie diet, the acceptable macronutrient distribution range that correlates with the lower risk of chronic disease is actually anywhere from 225 to 325 grams of carbohydrates a day.
Which really reinforces the undeniable physics of weight gain. I mean, fat storage is a mechanism of total energy balance. It is the result of consuming more total energy than the body expends. It is not the result of, like, a unique moral failure tied to eating a piece of sourdough bread.
Precisely. The biological systems will store unused energy as body fat, regardless of whether that surplus originated from complex carbohydrates, dietary fats, or proteins.
So if the brain demands a strict minimum of 130 grams just to function, and eating over 200 grams is perfectly healthy for an active person, it really begs a question, why did the ketogenic diet explode as the ultimate weight loss solution?
Good question.
Because if you look at standard keto protocols, they have people dropping their carb intake down to like 20 or maybe 50 grams a day.
Well, to understand the popularity of the ketogenic diet, we have to look at how the body manages a state of perceived scarcity. When you drastically reduce carbohydrate intake below that 130 gram minimum, the liver realizes the brain is facing a severe fuel shortage.
Right.
To prevent a systemic shutdown, the liver shifts its metabolic pathway, begins breaking down stored fat into alternative fuel molecules called ketone bodies. This specific metabolic state is known as nutritional ketosis.
And when someone starts a keto diet, they inevitably step on the scale after the first week and see, you know, a 7 or 8 pound drop. And that immediate feedback makes them think, wow, carbs really were the thing making me heavy. But that initial drop is kind of a physiological illusion, isn't it?
It is, yeah. The illusion is driven by water depletion, As we discussed, glycogen is the storage form of glucose. Mm. But what we didn't mention is that glycogen is incredibly hydrophilic.
Oh, meaning it loves water.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For every single gram of glycogen your body stores, it stores approximately 3 to 4 grams of water right alongside it. So when you severely restrict carbohydrates, your body burns through its existing glycogen reserves. And as the glycogen is utilized, the attached water is just flushed out of the system. The rapid weight loss on the scale is almost entirely water weight.
To be fair to the medical literature we're citing, though, keto is not just a fad. I mean, it has heavily researched clinical applications.
Oh, it absolutely does. Institutions like Harvard Health and Medline Plus document the efficacy of ketogenic protocols for specific medical conditions, most notably in managing drug-resistant pediatric epilepsy.
Right.
Under strict clinical supervision, it can also be a tool for short-term weight management. However, those same institutions explicitly caution against adopting a strict ketogenic diet as an everyday, long-term lifestyle choice for the general public.
Because you are effectively eliminating entire categories of nutrient-dense foods.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. By restricting carbohydrates so severely, you are inherently stripping your diet of complex fibers.
Mm-hmm.
You also often see a dramatic increase in saturated fat intake, which can negatively impact LDL cholesterol levels.
Right.
Furthermore, you just lose out on a vast array of phytonutrients, vitamins, and minerals that are exclusively bundled within whole fruits, grains, and legumes.
You know, I always try to visualize keto using a donut spare tire analogy.
Ooh, I like that. Let's hear it.
Well, if you get a flat tire, that little donut spare in your trunk is an incredible backup system. It will safely get your car off the side of the road and slowly get you to the mechanic. But it is fundamentally not the tire the car was engineered to drive on.
Right.
So if you leave that little spare on your car and try to drive at highway speeds from Chicago to Dallas for months at a time, you are risking massive mechanical failure.
That's a highly accurate way to conceptualize it, actually.
Mm-hmm.
The human body possesses remarkable metabolic flexibility. Ketone production is a brilliant survival mechanism to keep the brain fueled during periods of famine or severe restriction.
Yeah.
But, you know, surviving a famine is vastly different from providing the body with the optimal fuel it needs for long-term health and peak function.
Okay, let's pivot to the larger cultural question. If complex carbohydrates like potatoes, beans, and grains aren't to blame for the rise in metabolic diseases, and extreme restriction diets aren't the sustainable answer, what actually broke the modern diet?
The culprit isn't the carbohydrate itself. It is the extreme industrial processing we have subjected it to. And this is where the newly released 2025 to 2030 Dietary Guidelines for Americans make a staggering shift in policy.
They really do.
They point the finger directly at added sugars.
And the shift in those guidelines is just profound. I mean, for years, the messaging was always, you know, everything in moderation.
Right. The previous iterations of the guidelines suggested that Americans could consume up to 10% of their daily calories from added sugars. For a standard diet, that equaled about 50 grams. Or roughly 12 teaspoons of added sugar a day.
Wow.
The 2025 to 2030 guidelines have completely reversed course.
Mm.
The new official stance is that zero amount of added sugar is recommended.
Zero. They have completely removed the buffer.
They acknowledge that if added sugar must be consumed, the absolute ceiling should be capped at 10 grams, which is roughly 2 teaspoons per meal.
Yeah.
And to put that into perspective, current CDC data indicates the average American adult is consuming closer to 17 teaspoons of added sugar every single day.
And I know exactly what people are thinking when they hear a statistic like 17 teaspoons. I mean, I used to think the same thing. You assume that applies to people drinking massive sodas and eating pastries for breakfast. You think, well, I drink black coffee, I don't eat cake, so my sugar intake must be near zero.
Right.
But I was looking at the labels on the condiments in my own pantry recently, and it is honestly shocking.
It is a massive systemic issue within the food supply. You are likely consuming significant amounts of added sugar without ever tasting anything sweet.
Because it's hidden.
Exactly, because the food industry aggressively utilizes sugar in savory flavor profiles.
Yeah, I was looking at standard ketchup, jarred marinara sauce, barbecue sauce, even the whole wheat bread. But the one that really caught my attention was the quote-unquote light salad dressing.
Oh, the low-fat and fat-free products are some of the absolute worst offenders.
Mm-hmm.
Fat provides a significant amount of the mouthfeel and flavor in food.
Right.
When food manufacturers chemically strip the fat out of a salad dressing to market it as low calorie, the resulting product honestly tastes terrible. So to compensate for the loss of flavor and texture, they inject it with immense amounts of added sugar or high fructose corn syrup.
So you are sitting there eating a bowl of mixed greens, genuinely believing you are making the healthiest possible choice for your body, and your dressing is essentially a flavored syrup.
Pretty much.
Highly processed foods are basically doing candy's job, but they are hiding behind a health halo.
And that phenomenon is precisely why the general public developed a fear of all carbohydrates. They have been navigating a food environment saturated with invisible added sugars and highly refined grains, like white flour that has been mechanically stripped of its protective fiber matrix.
Wow.
Consuming that profile of food year after year causes rapid blood sugar spikes, subsequent energy crashes, and drives the metabolic dysfunction linked to chronic disease.
And they blame the wrong thing.
People felt the negative health effects, looked at the nutrition label, saw the word carbohydrates, and condemned the entire nutrient class.
They basically indicted the potato for the crimes committed by the high fructose corn syrup.
Exactly. They blamed the foundational complex structure for the damage caused by the hyper-refined simple sugar.
So bringing all this physiology and chemistry back to the actual plate in front of us, the core takeaway from this deep dive is that carbohydrates are not inherently fattening or dangerous if you prioritize the correct molecular structures.
Right.
We are talking about whole food, complex plant sources, oats, black beans, sweet potatoes, whole fruits. These are foods where the carbohydrates are still locked inside their original fiber matrix. They're bundled with water, allowing them to provide sustained energy without overwhelming your bloodstream.
Which perfectly echoes the final simplified directive of the 2025-2030 guidelines. The prevailing medical advice is to eat food in its real, original form.
Keep it simple.
Exactly. The guidelines specifically advise prioritizing 2 to 4 servings of fiber-rich whole grains daily, scaling with your specific energy expenditure. They recommend a baseline of 3 servings of whole vegetables and 2 servings of whole fruit every day. And crucially, they advise making added sugars and highly refined packaged grains an absolute rarity rather than a daily staple.
We have covered a massive amount of ground today, from the chemical bonds of sugars to the SGLT1 transporters in the jejunum, the glycogen storage tanks in the liver, and all those hidden sugars in our modern food supply. But I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, and it has to do with the fiber we just mentioned.
The indigestible bonds.
Right. We established early on that fiber is a complex carbohydrate built by plants and that human digestive enzymes physically cannot break those bonds apart. It survives the stomach acid, it bypasses the brush border enzymes in the jejunum, and it passes entirely intact into your large intestine, the colon.
Right.
And that is exactly where it meets the gut microbiome.
The trillions of bacteria that reside in the lower digestive tract.
So think about that physical reality the next time you eat a bowl of steel-cut oats or an apple. The fiber in that food provides zero energy to your human cells. Because your body cannot digest it, you aren't actually feeding yourself.
That's a wild way to look at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By consuming fiber, you are acting as a host. You are catering a specialized meal exclusively for the microscopic bacterial colonies living inside you, colonies that regulate everything from your immune system to your mood. So the next time you sit down to a meal, it's really worth asking yourself, who are you really eating for?
Thank you for listening to the Healing Plate Podcast. Eat well and be happy.